quorum.
Judge your sentence. How about that?
Yeah.
Like I said, Joan can't be here, so I'll go ahead and get things started. Did y'all receive a copy of the
draft
document? I put that together as a straw man. Chad asked at the last meeting that we sort of put, I guess, on paper the things we talked about in terms of finding an SAV bid, you know, where the potential for an SAV bid, or sort of articulate what the policy is in terms of our administrative review and what we recommend, you know, in terms of permitting or use of SAVs, and then how to deal with structures already in an SAV bid. So there's at least something in there, I think, that covers each of those topics. And I think what I'd like to do today is just start with the document. I've got here on the PowerPoint those several of those sections listed, and we can go through it and talk about it. Some of the background information there, I don't know if there's a whole lot of debate on, you know, what we should say about the background. I will say that I got an email over here from John Kennedy. Y'all picked it up or not? In response to the draft, they made a comment that they would like to see a sentence in there just acknowledging the work quality standards and criteria. And I think that could be added to that little background section, either as they put it in there or maybe there's a different sentence. But I don't really have a problem with that at all. A couple little other edits in there regarding the nature of what's changed, you know, where SAV is. It seems reasonable. So I don't see those as substantial changes, and would consider those unless someone else has a problem with it. But with that said, I think what I'd like to do is just highlight in our discussion each of the sections that are important here, I think, that all of us might have something to say about, talk about any edits or issues we might have or what we could view as potential changes. We go from there. I mean, it'd be a very short meeting if you told me that everything looked great right now and we could move forward with it, take it to the commission. But that's probably wishful thinking. So I'll go through it.
We have to earn our paychecks.
Yeah, come on. You know, you're not supposed to make work harder than you have to do. So I thought it was. Is that okay that we just go through the document today and just take it sort of piece by piece? It's not long. I didn't try to make anything too grand here.
In fact, Tony, I think unless somebody has an objection on the first page, I think we'd go right to the second page.
I think you're probably right. Yeah. I think the second page is really the meat of what it is that we'll probably talk about. So anyway, the only changes in the first page might be adding in what DEQ had suggested. And I didn't think it really changed it a whole lot. So on the second page of the draft, start out with, it's on the first page. We do define SAV, and I wanted to point that out. This came from some previous documentation we had on what constituted SAV. I thought it was important that we just acknowledge what it is we're talking about here, just so we don't get confused that it's macroalgae or some other, you know, something else that's in the waterway. So we've defined it here. For Bob's benefit, I put in hydrilla. That hydrilla was not in this list that we had previously seen coverage at different places, so I added it here.
Well, anyway,
So I added it, and I didn't think it would matter a whole lot to this group from a selfish standpoint because
it's fresh water.
SAV and shellfish in the same spot, but our shellfish and hydrilla in the same spot generally.
Is hydrilla still considered an invasive in Virginia? But it's still invasive.
It's everywhere. They call it a non-native invasive exotic. It's like milk well was around in the 50s and just say covered 200,000
component in certain areas, and very important in various fishery resources. So the term pioneer species seems to be more attractive from a resource management standpoint than invasive. Anyway, with that said, this is the definition. It just highlights the various species that we're, I think, talking about here, and so I thought it was important to include it. Just a little bit of background then on page one on the why SAB is important. And I do want to say that, you know, in our code, and I don't reference the code sections here in this draft, and maybe it should be referenced, 28.2, 1204.1, you know, asks the commission to have criteria defined in an SAB bed and criteria to determine where SAB, you know, might be in the future. And that's what really what we're doing here. And like I said previously, we have used the Bay Program mapping that Bob does as where what is an SAB bid, and we've used the 185,000-acre goal of where SAB had ever been, sort of in the Bay, as the criteria where it could be. But you know what we recognized is that because of changes that have occurred and where we're seeing SAB and not seeing SAB, that we just can't rely on the last previous year's information to define a bid, nor is it appropriate to maybe use the 1985 criteria on our, you know, goal area on what could be an area where SAB will be. So what I've tried to do here is define a bid and where it could be based on some different issues. So with that said, let's just go to the criteria for defining a bid. And you'll see what I've got here. And what this is attempted to say is that where SAB is mapped through the annual survey and the various densities they show, the least dense area is this up to 10% coverage, that anything that's mapped would be an SAB bid if it was mapped during the last or the previous 5 years. So if it was 5 years, if the SAB occurred in a given area during that five-year period and you mapped it and did a composite, that would be your SAB map. So from a resource management standpoint, it would avoid the conflict of, well, it just wasn't here this last season and therefore I can start using that area for aquaculture or something else when it had always been a bid for years before and it's expected it's just going to come and go and it's not something that disappears for a long period of time.
But it's got to have 10% coverage.
Yeah.
10% up to 10%. Well, that, I guess it's really zero 10%, right? You start to see SAV. That's captured in this definition. And if Bob, you want to talk about it, Bob's here, and he feels that where you have the sparse SAV coverage, you have significant ecological benefits associated with that. So it still functions. Provides some of the same ecosystem values in a sparse bed as you do in a very dense bed. And I don't know how much you want to talk about that, but we think that's important.
How would you figure out 10% coverage? How does that happen?
Well, I'll let Bob describe that.
It's a methodology that we adopted back in 1978, and there is a methodology that you can use for assessing cover of plant populations. Cover estimate based on a scale, and you can arrange the scale however you want based on the coverage classification. So if you have anything from 0 to 10, 10 to 20, 30 to 40, we're going to do what we did, you know, 0 to 10, 10 to 40, 40 to 70, 70 to 100. So we have four classification schemes that when we do our mapping, we make a visual estimate based on this cover scale methodology that is embedded in every one of our annual reports. Consistent, you know, from the time we started the survey in 1978. Actually, we started using it a lot earlier, but 1978, when we had the first baseline survey, we adopted that tool, that technique for assessing the cover. And again, wrong with K-scale is something goes back into the 19th century. Many people use it for very quick analysis of going and looking at cover on bottom. Found that we're doing assessments from aerial imagery. It was the best thing out there. That's what a lot. And a lot of people have essentially moved in that direction. So what we started, people have followed. Some use fewer classifications. Some use no classifications.
Are there places, are there other places that would have been taken out of, that would not be defined as SAV bids, in your experience using this?
Well, we haven't used it, no.
Oh, well, I'm just saying, if, just in your mind.
You might, let's take a good case in point. Up in York River, okay, from Gloucester Point, going up River towards Gloucester Point. Bluegrass beds used to dominate the shallow water areas up to just past Claybank, and both sides of the river. And Agnes, it essentially influenced the bluegrass distribution of the York River. We have not seen bluegrass in the upper York River since 1972. Okay. We've done repeated restoration transplant projects using plant bluegrass as kind of a test animal, let's say, to see whether the water quality was supported. The plants just don't make it anymore above Gloucester Point. So to me, that might be an area to think about. You know, if someone says, hey, I'd like to work somewhere around Mumford Island or around Catlett Islands, where it's fairly shallow, and just offshore, of course, where certainly a lot of the natural waters, paved block, those are all those types up there. So, in a lot of shallow water areas, that the question is whether bluegrass will ever come back. You know, I like to be an optimistic person, but I have a feeling that it's going to take more than a heck of a lot of changes in water quality and clarity to make things happen. You never know.
But can't you manipulate the percent coverage by choosing the geographic area or the size of the, quote, bed? In other words, if you've got a 100-acre area and you've got 10 acres of grass in it, that's 10%. But if you have 200 acres that you're trying to define as the bed, and 10 acres of grass, you're only at 5%. So does that figure into the calculations that you have? Okay.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's confusing here is if you imagine a shoal that has very sparse grass covering almost the entire shoal,
mm-hmm.
we draw an outside boundary around all the grass. We have a minimum distance between any grass that can be included inside that bed. As we draw that outside boundary around all that grass, and then we go back and say, okay, well, given that, how much of that is low density, middle density? So we're adding a little extra information about the coverage. It's not that we're carving out big empty areas
mm-hmm.
That we could manipulate that way. Those would be carved out if they were large enough to not fit our known mapping unit. So that sort of manipulation is not as easy to do. You could do it if you were doing a pixel basis, where we were kind of including very small areas. But because of the general large shoal size polygon we're producing, it'd be harder to do that, to manipulate it to get a pixel.
That, to me, is just as important then as the 10% coverage. How you're defining the polygon, how you're defining the shoal, because that's going to give you the area of your, call them polygons, the area of your polygon is what's going to be used to base the percent coverage on.
Well, and I think I might have heard something different, but when I first read this, I read this as,
ooh, that's not good.
Interesting.
PowerPoint's still up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Recording still seems to be running.
Yeah.
So anyway, I read this as having a minimum of 10% coverage in order to be included in a bid, but I heard Tony say between 0 and 10%.
That's Tony. Between 0 and 10, it's not.
Yeah. He needs to clarify it because we brought that issue up before. And so you want to clarify what you meant by
Well, that? Yeah, and
I thought you meant that less than 10% coverage is not, quote, not an SAV bed.
To go to a map, and that's where maybe the words need to be.
Yes. Is there any reason why you have that part where it says with to over or something? There's a whole part about density. It doesn't seem to
Yeah, it's kind of different words than the map uses, but here's one of the maps.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
0 to 10% coverage right here. And there's some yellow. Okay.
So that would not be
That would be an SAV bed. So that's a total misunderstanding, I think, on everybody's.
Yeah.
Why is that phrase in the definition? What goal does that phrase have?
The goal was to try to identify what's mapped at the least dense level we count as a bed.
So you're saying that if it's 8% coverage, is an SAV bed?
If it falls in this category.
Well, then,
so this.
Then there is absolutely no category that is not an SAV bed if there is no, unless there is no strands of SAV on it.
I mean, Bob told you why he
not
right.
maps it. And I'm saying if he maps it, it counts.
Okay. As they said, we have minimal mapping units.
Right.
Protocols that allow us to identify how far beds or patches have to be before it's
right.
mapped.
Right.
There are areas that may have patches that are so far apart that we don't map. So there are places out here, and you can see on some of our maps sometimes we'll have ground data.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have no polygons, and people will go, oh, there's some grass there. That's because, again, from the standard protocol map that we have developed, which by EPA,
mm-hmm.
because all of these procedures have to be approved, you know, through APC plans. And so all of these definitions that we use that have been approved in by the Bay Program and the states use in assessing achieving restoration targets, they use our categories that go from, you know, far 0 to 10. So they're all beds. Regardless of whether the density class is there, they use the total acreage as a measure of achieving the restoration target for a particular set.
So remember, this is decibel at 12,000.
Right, right. Well, yeah, this is a very confusing definition, and because I read it to assume that if it was less than 10% coverage, it was not an SAV bed.
We expressed that concern to Tony in an email to him, and he agreed that.
We can reword this, and it's to recognize the up to 0 to 10% mapped coverage.
But again, you know, getting back to the question of areas that, you know, fall out of this category, I'm using an example of the Upper York River, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, from 1972 to today, there has been widely may not be.
Right.
So that's a good case example.
No, I understand why that's not an SAV bed.
Right.
But the definition is confusing.
And I think we got that. But let's, if we can put this in simple terms for people that did not spend time at VIMS, I would appreciate that. But
sorry.
So right now the definition, as I understand it, is based on VIMS maps that are revised annually. And an SAV bed would be anything that is on those maps each year. This proposed change would change it to if it was in there once over a five-year period, it would be considered an SAV bed. So basically, we're going to be encompassing a lot more areas as SAV beds because it would only have to satisfy being an SAV bed once out of 5 years as opposed to just the most recent definition.
Right.
So you're including the whole five-year history rather than just the past year.
Right.
Okay.
I think one other tweak, Tony, would be when I read the ordinance, it refers to existing beds quite a bit. So I think it's confusing because there are folks that would say, well, I don't see any.
Well, what we're trying to do, for me, keep in mind what we're attempting to do.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to define what a bed is based on the documented coverage that occurs in certain areas.
Sure.
And if it disappears 1 year, but it's been there the previous three or previous 20, is it no longer a bed, or should it still be a bed if you expect it to come back in that year?
I understand that, but I think the issue is whether it's an existing bed, because, again, for people who are not attuned to things, they're going to say, well, I don't see any, so it's not an existing bed, when really what we're saying is within a five-year period, there may have been something. Is that not really the definition that we're headed towards?
Right, and what's existing, a bed, we know from a certain in winter time some of these species are gone.
Right.
You don't see them.
Yes.
Okay. So is it not a bed in the winter if it's a bed in the summer?
And
is that the previous 5 years? It's not there 1 year.
Right.
Is it not a bed anymore?
Right.
That's what we're trying to get at. We're trying to do this so that you can look at a map that gets up to
particular area. So let's take some of the events that have occurred recently with BVBAT and Gilgrass. So following 2005, BVBAT, the number of beds identified as one or low density were much higher. Mm-hmm. And those one beds increased in subsequent years.
When you say increased, they went up from 10 to 10 to 40.
Yes.
Okay.
There's been for Gilgrass long-term historical change because there's been a combination of decreasing water clarity and increasing temperature. So if you look at the present coverage, and we could show you an interesting series of slides that are showing SAD beds at the lower York River every year from 1840, and you can see how these beds act like an accordion. Density changes it. We can pull that up if you want to see that. That's an interesting way to picture how these beds change over time. Now, again, remember that the Bay Program goals are to improve water clarity, to enhance the SAD, to reach restoration targets in each of the segments. The restoration targets are based on what they call the single best year. So they looked at each of these places based on historical coverage and said, okay, our restoration target based on the same best year. This contrasts with earlier restoration target, in which they just said, let's look at all the areas that are less than 2 meters, 1 meter, and tier targets.
Mm-hmm.
And that was revised subsequently to looking at a single best year, knowing that we're not going to go back into John Smith's time. And we're going to look at probably more of recent coverage, in some cases maybe the 50s and upper bay where they had better coverage. They were totally in the 70s. So that's how the restoration targets were developed, is that they went back in historical coverage that when they had aerial imagery and created that single best year, which is now the restoration target for that we wanted to segment in the bay.
All right.
There are places in the bay where you have areas that, based on our development policy, that are we going to retain them. So, for example, as you get out of come out of on Hancock, those big marshes, large, gigantic, flat, well offshore. Most of those areas are now classified as desert. One, they were desert, but they persist now as a desert place. Well, then you get, as you get closer to shore, where there's less well, that's desert. And the way we make the boundaries is that when you see a significant change in the density coverage, then you draw the line that separates one, two, two from. So within a 200-acre, you could have, as you saw here, three or four densities.
Right. But what I was really getting at was, if it is a 0 to 10 coverage, what's the likelihood that next year it's going to be 0?
Well, like I said, it depends on the aerial coverage and the area. So in the lower York River, probably the probability of 1 becoming 2 is much greater. Take any more. Those beds expand and contract. The likelihood of that each area becoming 2 and 3 is much greater than, maybe an area off Great Point or Windmill, where
So if we reduce the years from 5 to 3 in terms of what we look back at, we're really not going to miss anything?
I don't know. I mean, that's going to take a little bit of kind of analysis. You know, it took 5 years for the rest to recover from the 2005 and 10 event. So I would argue that, you know, 5 years if we're going to try to redefine some of this, and maybe we need to rethink about how we define a bed. But when a bed of persistent areas of persistent grass versus, you know, areas like the Rappahannock, there's a big chunk of the Rappahannock that probably people would like to lease that used to have real grass everywhere.
Two things, and I'll let Ben add to this. We're looking at what's on the recent maps, the last year, what's showing up. And we're in the field, too. We're out there surveying every, for leasing purposes, we see it. Okay? But occasionally, though, depending on how we think things are changing in a given area, and in collaboration with JJ and Dave, we look at what's the potential. And that we looked at some of the, what we call the 2010 goal. It's that 185,000 acre, 77,000 acre area where SAV had historically been documented to see whether or not we're running into any conflict. So that's getting a little bit at your question about did we or didn't we lease something where there was not SAV. But typically what we've been avoiding in terms of leasing is just where we do not think there is any SAV now or has not been just recently. And that relied more on the year-to-year mapping and our field work. But we've run into some problems recently because it disappears for a season or whatnot, and but it's historically been covered for the most part. And so that's where we run into some of these conflicts.
And that's the dynamics of these bids that have changed radically over the last couple of decades, and probably more so in the last, you know, since 2005, when climate change is becoming more and more of an issue, temperature issues. If we're not sure where it's going to go, I mean, that's why exactly the surface is playing a big role. And we can monitor heat-related IDACs and then recover. And there are places that persist year in, year out. Again, the ones that are doing well are the ones that are in shallow water, the ones that are near the mouth of the bay, and near real water, they persist. You know. So, obviously, there are some distinct areas that have shown really coverage like the Rappahannock. The thing that's shown up in Rappahannock is Wichita. Mm-hmm. That's another player in the game that we're not sure what's happening because we've seen Wichita grass show up in areas that we've never mapped before. So, it's a crazy world these days. So, I think.
Wigeon grass pops up and disappears like almost overnight sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah,
right?
I mean, wigeon grass does that. We've been out where wigeon grass as thick as ever. You can get both through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we've seen that in surveys. You know, we'll have Tolls Point is the case in point, where in the 80s it was incredibly thick. We actually started putting no grass seeds up there as part of the restoration work. Never took. Years later, Wichita grass fired back. And this is not just Chesapeake Bay. Wichita grass does this throughout its range. So in North Carolina it happens, and Florida it happens. So, you know, this is just not a situation we need to prevent.
But that's, you got to mention that Wichita grass does provide amazing habitat.
Not disputing that.
Yeah. Now, whether Wichita grass is the quote seagrass of the future, we're not quite sure, but it certainly becomes more persistent in some areas than what we've seen before. And in some places like in Majak, for example, when we had the heat-related dieback of real grass and wichita grass, we had co-occurred. Wichita grass didn't die back. It was still there.
Mm-hmm.
So when we did the field assessments following these heat diebacks, you go in there and the only thing left is wichita grass. You can see the dead rhizomes of real grass. I mean, there were some beds that were left, and they're the ones that support the recovery process. So that's just kind of what we're seeing. And it's not just us mapping for aerial imagery. As Tom said, they go out to field. We go out to field quite often because we want to know what the heck is going on.
Well, I think the question that we're wrestling with right now is, Do we use a three-year benchmark, or do we use a five-year benchmark to decide what a bed is?
Well, right now it's a one-year. Am I mistaken in that?
I will look back 5 years and see what the trend is.
Okay, so their maps are done annually, but VMRC is not basing its leasing recommendation on the map, one-year map. It's looking at 5, 10. Okay.
We try to see what the trend is.
Okay.
And normally when we respond, we basically say, you know, again, here's the composite, here's what we see this year, and we try to give them the additional perspective on it. So, yeah, I think what Hank says, I mean, we work really well together, and as well as the staff on the Western Shore. Again, you know, we're all being asked when there are, you know, areas that are, you know, questionable. And a lot of times there has been some very interesting dynamics of, you know, trying to work really carefully with people that want to lease large areas and say, okay, you know, there are areas that are within this huge composite that we haven't seen grass forever since the composites were made. And carve out, you know, okay, here's where the persistent grass has been, and here are the areas where it's not. And I think then UMRC then leases areas that are outside of this. But what we've seen is that people lease huge areas, which we're not sure why.
So, Hank, you're essentially saying that right now there is an unwritten guideline for you to look back 5 years, 10 years, however many years you want to look back.
That's correct.
And this would actually codify how many years you would look back.
Right. Okay.
Nice
to have climb, start, and stop.
Right.
Right now, it's up to us. We're looking for trends.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, Tony brought up there before. Even these small patches that we see out there, remember, we see small patches. What we see from 12,000 are patches that are, you know, 1 square meters.
Right.
They show up. And that's what comes within the low density. The stuff that I shared with Tony based on a number of experimental work that we did, it was funded by the Recreation Fishing Board. We planted patches of different sizes. The fact is that there's no difference between a fragmented patch that was big versus small, a solid patch versus a fragmented patch. The animals are all using these patches regardless of the size. So even small patches provide significant ecosystem services to be safe. For the animals, which one of the iconic animals that we continue to sample are bluegrass, because they require bluegrass when they recruit in this in the fall. Like right now, bluegrass is requiring settling habitat. They find, you know, all the post larvae settling primarily seagrass. There are some suggestions that macroalgae also support settlements, but bluegrass is persistent, and so there is the requiring settlement.
All right, so I think, you know, we've had a good discussion about what constitutes a bed of SAV in terms of density, the fact that there are SAV plants in a given area, how they build a pod down around that. I think we're still at this issue of, is 5 years good, or is some other time period better? And we've heard that it took 5 years for the eelgrass to recover from that one die-off period. Like I said, it's my understanding that DEQ puts a three-year period for the water quality criteria, whether or not it's met. It's kind of a three-year period average. They use that composite. So I think we're somewhere in that range as to what is a reasonable period to look back where there's been SAV coverage. At least my sense of looking at the maps, like I showed for, this is happens to be Congress Creek at the mouth, and you're very familiar with that area. It's been pretty persistent. I mean, I think the density has changed from year to year.
But even though it might disappear in certain sections in 1 year, it's been pretty persistent as an overall bed for some time. So this 5 years would seem to pretty well capture that and not change a whole lot on what probably should be leased or where structures should go. And it just more clearly defines what would be a bed for the purposes of everybody knowing where we're starting to look. Let me just show you one other thing real quick. We talked about the 185,000 acre goal area of the 779 Annex in Virginia. When you start to map it for Hunger's Creek, the purple was the areas where it had always been the best year ever seen, whatever the historic record showed. The green was a more recent year.
But all of those under JJ's classifications would have been considered a bed.
Right, but the purple on that has never shown up recently. Okay. But in looking at this a different way, and looking at the composite that Hank just asked about for the last 5 years, and also a composite of what could be a bed in the future based on some additional period of review, and I'd had since 1985. You can see on this chart that the drop-down menu that Dave put together. Down near the bottom has 2010 to 2014. That's the five-year period. Mm-hmm. But then he went back to 71 to 12 to be the overall period. Because 71, I guess, is when you first started some surveys. And that's a different period than I've identified in the draft. Mm-hmm. But if you look at those maps, and this is a little bit hard to see, can you see the green line?
Kinda.
Yeah. This light on the projector is not real good. But anyway, that's the five-year composite. And the green line outlines the outside edge of it. So it's a lot like the filled-in map you saw before. Then we go to, I've also put here the 1971 to 2012 period, and there's a brown line on here. That's hard to see.
Sure there is.
There's the brown, there's the green, there's the brown, there's the green, there's the brown. They almost overlap in many areas. So that green, that brown line is getting at what could potentially be a bed, not what is a bed.
Right.
But Dave, he sent this to me this morning, and this is a screenshot of what you see on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure to make it clearer, we can work on the graphics and the colors and whatnot. But so to answer Hank's question, my theory, my proposal is that we pick a year, a 3 year period, whether it's 3 or 5, and that composite is mapped every year based on the annual survey, and it's updated annually. We then put that information that you see right there on all our lease maps, the same map you see online with all our leases on. And then the leaseholder and the public should know where the boundary of the SAB bed is based on that mapping information. Just for a little bit more information, here's the Severn River. This is a few years ago that the SAB coverage was. I picked an older slide I had from a previous presentation. That shows the 2010, 185,000 acre gold area, 77,000 acres in Virginia. You see the green lines again, they're very faint, but they're there. And then overlay with that is the brown lines. And the brown, green lines here, the brown line, a little further offshore, brown line there, green line here, brown line there. So the mapping data is there for Dave and I think for us to transfer into our lease maps to get it online. And I got to believe, based on the technology, we can do it annually as the data developed and improved.
So essentially what you'd be talking about is just taking the green line or something similar to it, some composite range, and saying these are the SAV bids.
Right.
And if you're applying for a lease and it's in there, we're going to tell you to make it out of there, or we're not going to be able to recommend leasing it. Okay.
Okay.
So the, your point of illustrating the green line and the brown line is just to show how it might change over time?
Yeah, the brown, the big, well, the brown line gets at the second item in the
potential.
Graph is what is the potential bid.
Okay. And can you educate me on why we have potential bids and how that affects the leasing process?
This is the what's in the text for the define the potential bid. This, the code that was established in 1999, it asked the commission shall in consultation with BIMS develop guidelines containing criteria for use in defining existing beds of submerged aquatic vegetation and two, delineating areas where there is potential for submerged aquatic vegetation restoration. So what we're, at the staff level, getting at is before we issue a lease or before we permit a structure in a given area where there might be potential restoration, are we inhibiting that restoration from occurring if we authorize that activity? And so in leasing, it's been a pretty clear policy that if it's an existing bed, we don't recommend leasing it. Documented on the ground, there's been coverage for the last few years, we looked at the trend, it's a, we think it's a bed and we don't recommend it. But we, it, we have a little bit more work to do, I think, in our evaluation each time we sort of see something proposed in a potential bed. And that's where we collaborate with them and we begin to look at this issue of what David is talking about. Is there a decent chance, based on their scientific judgment, that there that there's a trend of expansion in that area, or has it just not been seen in the last whatever many years, and the potential based on the current conditions is that it's just not coming back? Then we're comfortable leasing it, just at the staff level. But that level, that area that defined as the potential bid, just requires, in my mind, based on this concept of the draft here, a bit more scrutiny with JJ and his team to determine what's happening in that area today, or we expect to happen in the future. So we can lease in there at staff level, or permit something in there at staff level with regard to the SAV regulations of what's allowed in an existing lease. It would not prevent, in my mind, as it's drafted, putting cages in areas where there's potential for SAV. SAV cages are only prohibited on existing SAVs.
So did you look at the areas, for example, you know, there's still a fair amount of pulsing that occurs in some very, very specific areas that potentially could be. So, for example, you know, let's go back to the case in point where the Coast Guard area would have still a very active pulsing. And, you know, us working DMRC said, okay, let's look at the defined corridors or the pulling of the necks, which has worked pretty well. And that's something that reports to the commission. And without going through a whole bunch of ordinances and regulations, you know, that, that seemed to work well. It also minimized the scarring from the pelvis body. Talking about the best time to haul or whatever, so we minimize the scarring.
I mean,
the other problem that we're going to get at is that these areas, you know, are areas that people have hauled for generations. You know, leasing them and allowing, you know, cages could be a problem because then the whole thing is.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we do a public interest review for every lease application. And if there's a report that that area is using a pulsing, that's taken into consideration before we issue that lease. And if it's objective because it's traditionally been a pulsing area, I feel comfortable that we're not going to move forward with
objections to lease in the spot was due to halting. No, it happened. And I think we take that into account.
So can you, going back to SAV, can you simplify again for me what the procedure is today, where you look at a composite? We have kind of two criteria. Is it an existing bed? What is the procedure for potential beds today versus what's in this document?
I would say potential is more this trend issue that Hank's alluded to, and then in our collaboration with them, do we think there's a real problem as it is expanding in a given area? I'll be honest with you, as we tried to utilize that, what I'm going to refer to as 185,000-acre gold area, I realized that just doesn't work well, and we're reluctant to recommend at staff level not leasing in some of those areas just because it's 185,000 acres. It's more from a just day-to-day work and what we recommend. Looking at the trends and collaborating with JJ when we think there's a conflict with the trend.
Okay. So to simplify that in my own words, basically today you're almost combining the two processes from an existing bed and a potential bed. And on the document going forward, you've kind of delineated them out and said we have a defined criteria for an existing bed. Mm-hmm. And then we've got in this certain area that you're using 1971 to current date would be a potential for SAV bed, and that we're going to, where that's sort of the gray area. So that's almost where we'd use today's process, is in that gray area.
That's a good way to say it.
Yeah. Okay.
But the gray area does not prevent you from leasing it.
No, it doesn't.
I think that's some of the confusion as well, at least with industry, because when you say potential for SAV, they all say, oh, well, shoot, we're not going to be able to lease it because there's potential for SAV.
I think we as an agency, you know, have some obligation in code to protect SAV, an obligation to identify what's potential SAV, and then, you know, allow for uses consistent with that obligation. And that's what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, just looking at it and looking at those two tiers, I think it's a good framework to think through this, and one that I think people are going to be able to understand better once we sort of publicize it. And the online tools, I think, will get rid of a lot of this heartache. But I would personally, given that we have that gray area that is going to be a more scrutinized process reviewed by VIMS, and it's going to encompass anywhere from 1971, which is four decades ago, I'd probably be more in favor of the first level being the DEQ level of 3 years, given that you have that fallback level that is pretty expansive in my mind.
Segment of
Gotcha.
What you're doing, but there is a town with another rate. Is that, put in other words, they look at segment?
It's about base segment.
How much SAVs in the segment, and
yeah.
that's for a 3-year issue.
Yeah.
Not so much
I think
what size.
The variability is grand all over the place. It's not, and it's not a linear change everywhere in the same.
I think what precipitated this in this 3-year cycle is the fact that a lot of the water quality measurements, because they want to use water quality papers, that the water quality was being conducted primarily in main stem and main rivers, and that's not much where escrow is. So the whole idea was, let's try to assess the variability that occurs in the shallow water areas. So right now, VIMS and Maryland, VIMS has the grant. Every 3 years, they go out and assess water quality in specific areas of the bay every 3 years. And then they move to another area, and then they move to another area. So it's the idea of what's going on in the shallow water areas, and they look at, that crew doesn't do anything with SAD, primarily water quality measurements. And it's run in shallow water, and they have what's called a data flow. So they're measuring instantaneous measurements of water quality parameters. And then they put out these instruments or data songs that at specific locations gives that data every 15 minutes. And they're looking at, as Rob said, the variability. So like this year, they're doing the bay studies for sure. In the past, they've done the module studies. So they're moving around the bay, and this is a program that's been going on for probably 12 or 13, 13 years. So, and then the same thing's happening in the upper bay. They're trying to get an idea of the variability of the person water quality that will influence SAD. Now, remember that there are the water clarity acres that are also looked at, but they're defined in a very different way than SAD is.
So the difference in scale is very important from a geographic standpoint, that if you're looking at there being a couple thousand acres in an object, that's a little different than saying there's 300 foot by 200 foot area next to this pier that hasn't had grass for years. Those are two different questions.
Sure. And I guess thinking about this, and I still want to make sure I understand this correctly, but a lease application comes in, and if it falls within whatever this first test that we define is, whether it was in the past 3 years or past 5 years, in almost all cases, I would think that area is going to be almost exactly the same as we saw, is that brown line and that green line. There was very few places that weren't encompassed by either one. I mean, is this really doing anything?
Using 5 years, you mean? I mean, or 3 years?
Yeah, so walk me through. A lease application comes in, and if there was SAV on it, and let's just call it 5 years for right now, if there was SAV on it in the past 5 years, the decision tree is going to tell the commission to not recommend leasing it.
Right.
If there wasn't SAV on it in the last 5 years, your decision tree is going to say, okay, is it a potential SAV area or not?
Right.
If it's not, your decision is going to say recommend leasing it.
Right.
If there is, your decision is going to say, let's get some more feedback from VIMS, and we'll have to. That's the gray area,
mm-hmm.
kind of.
Right.
So.
The thing is, now BMRC has at the fingertips without even having to discuss. I think it's a nice relationship that we have, but they have at their fingertips, the data that we will get too. So,
sure.
I think what they would like is because we do so much more than just math. We have the logical, historical perspective of what's going on. I think it's the relationship that I think has worked very well in the system that recognizes, and we recognize the emerging current reports of agriculture.
Yeah.
But we also have to recognize the significant logical values of these grass-fed and that they look at why DEQ and other agencies who may not have the same interest as you all have. Balance that we all have to work with coming up with an appropriate compromise.
some of the things that we see when they ask us, I'm just telling you what, we don't see everything. They're usually asking us some of these controversial cases where somebody want, you know, a huge chunk of shoreline in which beds, you know, vary the edges. And so what they and I can do is look carefully and be basically tell them, this is what we see, you know, make any of those decisions. And you know, just say, here's what we see in terms of, you know, persistence of that safety over various time periods.
Right. But
Chad, I agree with you. If all of a sudden from 3 years to 5 years we don't see any green or yellow, but it's still inside that brine, we're still in the same boat.
That's what I'm trying to get at, is why do we have these two separate classifications when I think less than 1% of the time are we actually going to find an area that's in
the gray area.
Yeah. The gray area is going to be 99% of the time. Yeah. So it kind of, how often are we going to find an area that doesn't have SAV on it in the last 5 years that hasn't had SAV on it since 1971? So you're talking about, I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, it's probably a potential 77,000 acres.
I mean, it's somewhat less than 77,000 acres.
Yeah.
We know the brown line's not.
That's the whole thing. The
Virginia portion is 77,000 acres. And so, you know, the brown is going to be somewhat less than that. That was the reason for picking a more recent documented year period as opposed to the composite of best year coverage forever, which constituted that 77,000. So, you know, currently within the bay, we've got 120 or 30,000 acres of lease. Not all those overlap with SAV areas. So, yeah, there are a lot of areas where you're going to have that overlap, but there's a lot of areas where we're not going to have that overlap, where SAV's not been documented. I mean, so, you know, whether we include it or not, I mean, I think we're obligated to recognize the potential of it occurring. But the question is, can we map that so that you as a user going in and us as a manager, when we review your application, have a spot where we know that's going to be an issue we have to consider.
Sure. But go back to your decision tree. You've got SAV in the last 5 years.
Right.
If the answer is no, you still have to look at, have you had SAV since 1971?
Or single best year. I mean, that's the thing that
positive. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
But at that point, it's not been there for 5 years, and it wasn't there for the previous 5 years, and we go to JJ and he says, it's not going to come back there, then we don't have to worry about it. We can at least.
But why not just make it since 1971, if that's the case? Because the two are.
So you're saying back to beds since 71.
Well, think about it. You're saying, has there been SAV in the last 5 years? No. Well, then you're saying, has there been SAV since 1971?
Well,
if there'd been SAV in the last 5 years, there would have been SAV since 1971.
But I believe that he's talking about the leasing areas that are in the gray, whereas that tighter area, 5 years,
is an automatic no.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a good point.
That's
yeah.
Kind of the difference
in bureaucracy.
Yeah.
In your next paragraph, you actually state what you do.
Right.
So, Chair, I'm wondering, you know, would it be worthwhile to look at a series of, let's say, leases that have come before the commission to see exactly what was done? Because, you know, we never see the end product. You know, they ask us for information provided, we never get back. This is what happens. So, we're assuming that, you know, the staff looks at what's going on, our recommendation, then makes a recommendation, you know, to the commission, or makes that their own recommendation. I'm not sure if it comes to the commission with every lease. But it might be worthwhile to look at some case examples because, you know, gosh, we're getting more and more requests to look and provide information. And, you know, generally, it's like 50-50 places where they have SAV or not.
Sure, and I think once we had a...
You know, Chance, we're familiar with that, and, you know, we skip how it differently, we deal with it every day. I mean, I don't think we should lose sight of why we're here today.
Yeah.
That the commission asks that we consider our policies and look at how we apply them and report back, you know, with any suggestions for changes. At the last meeting, we kind of went through what we've just been talking about. What is our policy?
Yeah.
But we agreed that it needed to be sort of better articulated, you know, and that's really what we're attempting to do here. So, you know, I don't want to, you know, forget sort of what got us here, either from the last meeting or from the commission direction. And the commission direction was pretty much based on the fact that we've dealt with some applicants who wanted leagues in SAV, and we said no, it came to the commission. I think there's some thought in the industry that we weren't being fair, that we were applying the rules differently from one person to the next. And if we didn't have it written down clearly, then, yeah, maybe it seems that way. I don't think we attempted to do that in any way, shape, or form. And we've had some structures placed in areas where they did not think the person doing it or the group doing it didn't think it was SAV, and we thought it was. And it might have been because it disappeared the year before, or it wasn't there over the winter because it had gone from eelgrass to pigeon grass. So there's any number of issues that have come up with staff and with the commission that we're trying to, I think, put some criteria on so that everybody knows what the playing field is. And
I think one of the problems is
that's just where we are. And so, as Mike pointed out, this is what we've been talking about, and how we apply these definitions or criteria for what's a vesting bid and what's going to be a, what is a potential bid, and try to articulate in the next paragraph of what we would do.
Well, the decision, if it's a bed, is very objective. If it's a bed, it's a no. But the decision for a potential is very subjective. And that is where Hank and Ben and JJ come into the equation to decide whether or not the potential is great enough to not lease it.
If it's lease, and you know, we got to keep in mind that we don't just deal with leasing.
Right.
We deal with dredging channels.
Right.
We deal
sure.
with building
right.
areas. We deal with, you know, living shoreline projects nowadays, and we're seeing conflicts between SAV and living shorelines, and we're balancing what's better, more marsh or some SAV, and is it dense enough to, you know, justify allowing that, or not dense enough to allow justifying that living shoreline to go in. So, you know, this policy is written to be broader than just leasing and aquaculture. Well, I do or I did, you know, point out some
sure.
aquaculture yeah. terms and some leasing in here.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be a little broader than just
sure.
shellfish.
I will point out, you know, we've gotten from Hank, or mostly from Ben, or living shoreline, for those projects.
In mind too that may sound trivial, but this is a guideline.
Right.
You know, it's not a regulation.
Right.
So, you know, if an applicant for a pier, an applicant for a lease, included some SAV in a bed that's defined by what we've got here on paper now, insisted on having their day in court, it comes to the commission.
Tony, I think one of the things that I hear you talking about, you know, whether to lease or not to lease. One of the reasons I'm sitting here is having gone through the process of existing historical leases and then permitting within the lease the actual activity. And to JJ's point, we had a good meeting, and within a 20-acre lease, 5 acres were set aside for the activity because there was no thought that SAV would come forward. And so I think, and I don't think we want to lose sight that this isn't necessarily just about new leases. It's what do you do with the ones that are coming forward for permitting within an existing
Absolutely.
Historical lease.
Absolutely.
And by the way, it worked really well. That was
worked out.
It worked out great. Yes.
That's one of the interesting issues is that this is not the first time we've had, for example, Jinty. There was an area that was an old oyster bar that fell within the SAV bed, and of course, the way we define polygons, sometimes those areas get encompassed. So I believe Hank was on the Urbis, and the gentleman was allowed to lease that area because there was an existing oyster, and it wasn't big.
Well, yeah, there was an interesting on the our lease that we worked on. There was an interesting complication in that it was a current lease. In certain areas, we could not get permitted to put floating cages above it because of potential for SAV. But there was no SAV there, so we could have put down clam nets right there. And that's just an interesting kind of conflict there. That we couldn't get a new permit, but we could have made sure there was no SAV there ever again by putting down clam nets, and then eventually, I guess, have gotten a permit for floating cages, which probably would have done less harm than putting clam nets on that area in terms of SAV abundance. Not that I think we can solve that. It's just one of the many issues with this. Yeah.
Well, let's move forward for a minute. I mean, I think we've hashed out existing bed, potential bed issues. I know you've got some concerns, reservations, but let's set it aside before we come back to it.
Okay.
Let's.
We still don't have a time frame.
Right. I don't want to forget that we've still got something on the table with each of those issues before we walk out of here today. I don't know if we're going to solve this today or need another get together or not, but. I wanted to get to the point that Mike was beginning to make as we had this back and forth just now, that in the next section of the guidance, it sort of articulates what the policy is on how we'll go through this process. And that second paragraph there, that first sentence, was really setting the stage in my mind for what the commission will do. I use the word avoid there, permitting or allowing uses of existing beds.
Yeah.
I kind of like that. My staff had suggested that critically evaluate may go better with the rest of the paragraph, but to be honest, I think I'm dividing it into two sort of perspectives. It's just as we've talked about. If you're in a SAV bed or something's proposed in a defined bed, then don't expect the commission to support, staff support it, or the commission to approve it. You can ask, but don't expect it. If you're in an area where we have the potential for SAV bid, expect a more intensive review of the SAV issues by us in collaboration with VIMS, and we'll determine, based on that review, what we think is acceptable. And in either case, if the applicant or the lease applicant doesn't accept where we want to try to go at staff level to get the permit issued or the lease issued by making changes or whatnot, then we can come to the commission. With that said, if we determine that something could go in an SAV bed or something could go in a potential SAV bed, what are the mitigation issues?
issues we should consider. Avoidance, minimization, you know, could trays be suspended or floated at certain intervals to see if it either helps SAV or has no effect on SAV? How might you get to and from the bed or the structures and not harm SAV bed to prop wash and things of that nature? That's mitigation, avoiding minimizing. The compensation is, okay, we're allowing you to put something in an SAV bed, dredge through it, for example, to create a channel, just because it's got to be there. We've got to see some compensation. Plant SAV somewhere else, we know there's some problems with that. Are there other mitigate or compensation techniques we could utilize, out of kind of some sort? I didn't identify in this document a whole suite of what compensation might be, because I don't think we know what that answer is. And right now, you know, we're kind of scratching our heads over how we're going to compensate for some of these in-bay SAV impacts that we think are justified, because the restoration in the bay is not really working for it. So we've got to come up with some numbers.
Would you explain to me why mitigation is necessary if the ground is deemed leasable? It's deemed leasable, that means there is no SAV there. So why should mitigation be required?
May not be. Unless we leased it knowing there's SAV and knowing that the applicant had some plan for using it that would be mitigable.
Yeah, that's different than what you're saying here. That's different than what you're saying here.
If you think so, then maybe we can treat the words. And keep in mind, too, that, again, this was written with the idea that this is a broader issue than just leasing and aquaculture.
I can understand why you might want to have mitigation and compensation if you are going through a, quote, bed or even a potential bed. But if you're doing anything on a acceptable piece of bottom, I don't see why mitigation would be necessary.
Some of the policy to avoid authorization, if authorization is rooted back, we must mitigate.
Yeah. But that's not really what it says.
But that's not what it says. I understand that.
Well, I'm saying, let's read the sentence. And I think, is it, if authorization through permitting, through the permitting process of any structure and activity, is deemed acceptable, all mitigation measures must be considered and compensation of losses may be required.
So this,
I wrote that with the idea of mimicking our current Sebacus guidelines that says if something's permitted in SAV, then compensation is required.
So this is if in an SAV bed.
Right.
Not a normal lease.
Yeah,
but
right. Yeah. Okay.
If in an SAV. So this is basically allowing some flexibility of we may permit an activity in an SAV bed and require some sort of mitigation compensation.
That's what this was your point last week, was that maybe there's some opportunities to allow certain things in a bed if we can come up with a mitigated approach and a compensation approach. And some of this for, you know, aquaculture may be, can we show that there's some edge effect associated with floating structures or cages that you're in a great low-density bed, but if you put a few structures in there at the right spacing, you also get it much denser. I mean, maybe that's dreaming, but I don't think we'd want to preclude that type of opportunity.
First, I understand mitigation in a grass bed. That's not how I interpret that.
All right.
Secondly, I just have to say that there is a growing body of knowledge about the ecological benefits from aquaculture cages, clam nets, and what have you.
So, in my mind, this... this maybe provides that opportunity to take advantage of it. I like to think I was attempting to do here.
I understand, but like I said, when I first read that, I said, well, why do you mitigate if it's acceptable?
Yeah, I think that whole paragraph kind of falls in the bucket of if it's an SAV bed and we decide to do an activity anyway.
Yeah.
Is that sort of what you're getting at, Tony? Rather, we're already down the decision of this is an SAV bed. And I brought up the mitigation compensation point, kind of envisioning something to the effect of this area would be really valuable to our operation if there's an acre of SAV here. Maybe we'd be willing to fund planting 10 acres of SAV in an area suitable somewhere, but that acre is extremely valuable for aquaculture. And that there might be some world that VIMS gets behind it or whoever and says, hey, this would be a net positive. They get to lease their area that's valuable, and we get more SAV just in a different area. I think that's a long road ahead of us, but I'd like to envision some sort of potential for that kind of collaboration in the future.
Well, as this was put together, I'd like to think that was the concept.
Yeah.
Whether or not the words are the best way to describe it.
And that's what we're remembering that the intent of all of these rules and regulations that states have come down in terms of sediment, erosion control, nutrient management, buffer zones, everything, are all aimed to improve water barriers that would enlarge areas that could have SAB. A lot of our research that we've been doing suggests that even if an area looked really good,
Tony, can you explain the next sentence to me? Aquaculture structures that are not authorized by the commission regulation on SAV beds may only be authorized by permit. I kind of get the gist, but I think that's confusing.
Clarification sentence?
Okay. Sounds like that, a Lynn Haven effect.
Well, Lynn Haven effect. We have a case right now
right.
where there was some misunderstanding about whether it was SAV or not, and I think we're starting to resolve what was and what wasn't. Mm-hmm. And the point is that the regulation right now, there's two regulations that authorize cages or structures on leases. One is the on bottom less than 12 inches. It just says you can't put structures on SAV. The other, which is the general permit, has a little more, articulates what is SAV and what the criteria are a little bit more completely, but it's essentially the same thing. So what I'm saying here is that if it's an SAV bed, you cannot put a cage on there under this regulation. That's what the regulations say. But that if it's deemed permittable to have a cage there, you can apply for a permit to put a cage on that SAV. Kind of just clarifying or restating kind of what the previous sentence is, but specific to aquaculture cages.
So what does that do to people that have been operating under the regulation where you're allowed to put cages no taller than 12 inches but on a lease, but it says you can't put it on SAV?
Doesn't change it. All it says is that in the past, up until now, well, currently, since the regulation was adopted, you could not put a less than 12 inch tall cage on SAV. If you did, you're in violation of the regulation. There's no precedent. What this says is that potentially could get a permit to put it there, but you can't put it there under the regulation. You've got to go through the permit review process to get that cage permitted.
So you can continue to use the lease using 12-inch trays. You just can't put it on a stand of SAV.
That's right. Or where there's a bed.
And that's current regulation.
That's current regulation.
Right. Well, a bed, I mean.
But it says SAV.
So
the regulation says SAV. You can't put it on SAV.
So if this table has SAV and that table doesn't, on a lease, you can put the tray over there. You just can't put it here.
So what, I guess the question is, what is this sentence This sentence is clarifying, the first part clarifies the existing regulation, it almost seems.
I mean, really, it's just stating to me the obvious, but I thought it was important to put it in here, the notion that this group and why we're here was a result of aquaculture activities and leasing and how we can deal with SAV. That just says the regulations says you can't put it on SAV, but you could get a permit to do that.
Okay.
Following on Tommy's little question here about a lease that has SAV and a portion of the lease that currently does not have SAV, if we change the definition of a bed to what we talked about, his lease might be a bed, so he cannot then put structures on the section of the lease that doesn't have SAV?
Theoretically, yes.
Theoretically, no, he can't put it there.
I think yes, you're right.
Yeah.
Would it have really qualified as a bed?
We're talking about existing leases now, not new leases.
Right, exactly.
So, Tommy, if we change the definition of a bed, Tommy could not use that section of his lease for structures.
If we concluded that the regulation that says you can't put it on SAV means you can't put it on the SAV bed, and you know, I don't have the regulation in front of me. Does SAV bed or just SAV?
I've got it.
This definition would not apply to the regulations on the books.
Right. I mean, I think the regulation on the books would. Here we go, Joe. Got it. Existing stands of SAV versus beds of SAV.
Oh, man. The word smithers are going to have a great time.
I think the idea is that a stand of SAV and a bed of SAV probably would tend to be the same thing.
Yep.
There's a law that says beds. It's 99. The regulation that says stands was 1996. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a plot stand, like you can already work your aquaculture around in that 10% area, but if you're saying that's a whole bed, you have to get a permit for it. That's like the whole eastern shore.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm curious we have these meetings.
You have an insurrection.
Yeah, not just the eastern shore. I mean, a good portion of the York River.
Yeah.
I said a good portion of the York River, lower York River. Well, in leases, areas, working around areas where there was eelgrass, trying to avoid areas where there were grass. But if this definition is changed.
All right, let's look at a map and talk about this.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Under the concept we proposed for the fund of debt, these, let's say, just for argument's sake, this is the last 5 years of the policy.
Yep.
But this area, all what happened show up for the last 5 years is the 10%.
Right.
And what we're hearing is that we've got cages in these areas now because people don't think it's a bit. So sparse. As we've, I think, drafted this guidance up, the only way you could put a cage there would be by permit, wouldn't qualify for the regulation.
You'd have to go through general permit 4 or JPA.
Right.
Yikes.
Okay. And the general permit 4 says no structures on SAV.
That's right.
So the only option would be the regular permit, right? Okay. However, being sort of thinking outside the box, maybe, not to be shirking our management responsibilities of protecting SAV, but if it's not very dense here, and there is some concept that ecological benefits of aquaculture structures help enhance the area, could cages be allowed in this environment under the regulation, but not in these areas? Or so could we say that, again, that would mean amending the aquaculture regulation to say that they could put it in areas where it is up to 20%, whatever the next.
And it's not just oyster culture, it would be clam culture as well.
Yeah, I mean, it would be the nets, it would be the cages, it would be in the structure. So, I don't know if we could, I don't know how Ben feels about that. I mean, that's where we look to them for some technical and scientific advice as to whether or not that's a good management policy to follow or not. I think this is the, when you start asking these questions, you start looking at managing this differently and defining, that's what we're doing here. We're putting some tighter sort of parameters on what we've been trying to do here. Let everybody know what the playing field is, and you start doing that, I guess that's what's happening. You know, what's the solution?
Yeah, to piggyback on that, one of the things that I've been thinking about and tying it to the cycles, the 5-year, 3 and 5 years, that maybe we could look at doing floats if there's nothing happening within 3 years, and then cages within 5, that there might be a timing difference between that use. And of course, then looking
that may be a good thought process for the permitting review, and I think that's the kind of thing that goes into the calculus of deciding whether to grant a permit or not. I don't think that's necessarily a good idea for what time period we use to define it.
No. But what I'm saying is, within the context of the decision, and the identified time periods, then the techniques themselves could vary, with a floating cage having potentially less impact on a bottom, and still having the reviews, but assuming that floats are less impacting, it may be a little bit better synergy.
They're less impacting maybe for that, but there's an awful lot of property owners in most of the state, they're not going to want to look at that. So that's almost a non-starter, in my opinion.
But that's...
Just a question. Daily grounds. They go right up to shore. Are most of the daily grounds in
deeper water?
All over.
Never near. That's all we've got, I think, on that map.
It's a good way to put it.
Well, this question is going to come up when we get to the beds coming in around existing structures as well.
Here again, we go on to that one real briefly before we go back to anything. Is that this next last bullet in the guidelines? Is that what happens when you put something out there? It was a bid, but now SAV is coming around and it qualifies as a bid. And this is what we've always said. Can you keep it there? Can you use it? Replace it in that spot, but don't put it on the rest of the ground where there's SAV.
question about that. As long as they use the same 10 by 50 plot for that net, they can continue to use it. Some of the growers like to leave plots fallow for a year or two. If the grass colonizes that footprint, they can no longer use it. Is that correct? Based on what you're saying?
I would say yes, that's the intent.
Yeah.
I think that takes away a lot of their flexibility. They're probably leaving it fallow to let sand and everything fill back in some of the bed when they're disturb it from harvesting the clams.
Exactly.
Or whatever.
To improve the water quality.
So, I mean, I think we could come up with words to say that
once a footprint, always a footprint.
SAV moves around, and then you're working within that footprint of where your structures were when SAV moved in there. Mm-hmm. You can still continue to use that even if you leave the area fallow when SAV moves in. The question is do we know, or how would you document that or prove that?
I understand the problems.
And I mean, if we could, I guess it's an acceptable way to try to address your concern. But I don't know how we do it. Now, the way they're being set up for on bottom, nets or cages, less than 12 inches, is that the agriculture industry is on their own. It's up to the agriculturist to comply.
Right.
And we don't require any reporting. We don't do any monitoring other than what we might pick up in the annual surveys. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing that sort of documents what goes in any spot year to year. I mean, if we got to that, then yeah, if you wanted to document that, hey, Tony, we started this bed, there was no SAV, and we got this 100 by 50 foot plot. Well, next year we're going to leave half of it fallow, and we're going to come back a year later, so please be aware that if SAV comes in there, we're going to start using it. Right now we don't have that kind of reporting requirement.
Right.
Now, Tony, this is sort of that would be the result of a failure of this process, I understand, if grass comes back. Because our idea is to not be permitting areas when we think grass is going to come in.
Right.
And so if we see grass coming into an area that's been permitted for these uses, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
We're getting grass coming back. But it's also a failure of our process in some way in that we permitted an area that we didn't guess right about that being a really good thing for grass coming
in. I think it's not so much the future.
I was just going to say, it's already leased.
This stuff that's already leased and already been used and been used since 1990. I mean, if you look at the seaside or bayside of the Lower Eastern Shore, those nets and structures have been there since,
1982 or 3 for cherry stone.
The first sets of nets, we believe, were 1988. Because if you look at the 1987 imagery, you do not see any nets.
Right.
We don't have the EVA imagery. In 89, that's when the first set of nets that were there started coming, and then it hasn't stopped since.
You probably should look closer at 83, 84.
Okay.
So I don't know how to get at that.
It's going to be a problem.
I mean, I think that's where, for better or worse, we've tried to work with the industry, and there's some gives and give and take. And occasionally we'll say, okay, yeah, we understand what you're doing, and understand what your criteria was, or your rationale was, and you're all right. Other times we're going to say, no, we don't buy your story, and we think it's a violation. But how we sort of just allow what you just described, and whether it's appropriate from a resource management standpoint, I don't know. I don't think they've been to the point if he's coming back in there and continued use of that same 100 acre or 100 square foot plot, even through rotation, would result in also new SAV. Is it the best thing to do? And it's all balance.
Well, I'm uncomfortable with some of this stuff because I don't want to shoot myself and others in the foot that have been doing something under one set of guidelines since 1989 or 90. And we approve all of this and we're in violation tomorrow.
That's why I asked the question last month whether you wanted to go forward with this or not.
Right now, no, because I mean, these are things that we didn't think about or weren't, I mean, we didn't have this document that you presented us with.
Well, the draft is just an attempt to put in words what we were all talking about. Yeah.
So, if we were only looking at this from an aquaculture perspective, you know, the benefit this gives the aquaculture industry is not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot, yeah, exactly.
You know,
well,
I think that...
Yes.
The certainty in not having to go through the... Wayne probably hates this because we don't have to pay guys like Wayne to figure out the permitting for us. We can just look at your maps and say, nope, we're not getting that lease. And that is helpful. That can probably be done without a guidance document, I would think, the online mapping tools. Well, no, because what we have there is the judgment where you're looking at the last 5-10 years. And the overlay of the VIMS data with the VMRC lease data in one place, that could probably happen without a guidance document, to where we can pull up a potential lease we're looking at and say, let me see SAV from 2014, 2013, 2012, and we could get a glimpse of it and say, all right, when Hank pulls this up, he's going to see SAV there in the last 2 years and be able to tell. But other than that benefit, I don't see anything that's, you know, really makes anything easier on us here. And one of the sentences, the one Wayne so brilliantly pointed out, of aquaculture structures, I mean, that could potentially bankrupt my company tomorrow if it was in there. So, yeah, I'm with you that there's a lot of scary stuff. Without naming names, would it be possible to give us an overview of the case I think we all keep referring to that got us here, where there were oyster cages and grass moved in around them, and they were claiming there wasn't grass, and were claiming they were being forced to remove them? Could you give us an overview?
I'll start and then Hank fill in the blanks. How about that?
Okay.
We were advised that land aquaculture, oyster aquaculture cages, they're less than 12 inch tall pipe cage, appeared on NSA. We looked at the photography and looked at the information provided, and it was our position that area had been a persistent bed and that the cages had been placed on it. The aquaculturist side of it said, well, we just didn't think there was SAV there when we put it out there. Either it was an annual thing, or they put it out there in the winter, or they didn't think it was dense enough. It's not quite clear, but if you look at the imagery for that period, and it's going around, I mean, maybe you don't see it, I don't know. It's pretty clear that there have always been some SAV in that location. So our position is that Warren, what might come out of this work group, that is not covered by the regulation. You can't put cages in that spot on your list. There have been clam aquaculture in that area for years, in the landward side of the lease. SAV avenues around it, whether or not the SAB came in after the command if it put there or whether, you know, or not. Or it's just one of those areas where some of the clam stuff and SAV are kind of mutually exclusive. They don't always want to be in the same spot as much as maybe oyster cages will potentially be, because oyster cages can kind of go anywhere. Clam, you got to have a certain substrate, you got to have a certain depth. You know, it's a lot of things that don't always mesh with where SAV wants to be. But anyway, to make a long story short, our review of the documentation and the aerial photography, the monitoring that's been done by them suggests that area was a SAV pit and was SAV. And as a result, the regulation did not allow occasion to be there. So, moving forward, it seems we've got a couple choices. Remove them, get them off the SAV pit, or we could go through some subsequent review to see if they could stay under permit, and then what would that permit look like? Would there be some mitigation? Rearrange the cages, space them out more, and if some impact SAV was allowed, would there be some type of compensation, transplanted somewhere else, or something out of kind? Could we come up with some research, you know, or analysis that would be funded by the person who put the cages there to begin to get a handle on, you know, what do these cages do when you put them in a not-so-dense SAV? So that's where it stands. And it's not been resolved yet.
Okay.
We kind of put it on the back burner, so to speak, based on the commission request that we formed this work group. Hank, did I leave anything out that?
No, not really. After the last meeting, I got the impression he was going to show it and move it. So I realized after looking at the photos, he couldn't go so long. He didn't have a test case on his group where he contacted you that we had seen a bunch of clam nets put for the open register. And the compromise was rather than just removing everything.
And so, yeah, this is where we attempted to work with the industry when we run into these situations. Sometimes we've come up with a solution we can agree with from the manager standpoint and the agriculture standpoint, but I don't know if we're always going to reach that compromise. And that one, when JJ described, he didn't come to the commission for the resolution. We worked at it at the staff level. They agreed to make that nets after a period of time, and we accepted that.
He's the first one that I've had, and he's sure that once we confronted him, he wasn't willing to work out a compromise, make us work.
And I do think he didn't think that he was all dead until we presented the evidence from the aerial photography record.
Yeah. And so are there ways we can educate the aquaculturists on this as being a collaborative process? Because I can tell you from my point of view, we apply for a permit or something, and Hank tells us, Vim says there's grass there, so his recommendation is going to be we can't do it. And we never get a message of, well, let's talk about ways we could make this work, or something we might be able to do to use that. It's just a yes or no. And I think that's sort of what's gotten the industry frustrated here. I don't know how we do that. I mean, you know, I guess if we'd come back and said, we really want this, let's talk about something else. What can we do to help? Can we participate in the study? Would you be amenable to floating cages rather than clam nets? Or that we might have been able to work something out. But I think, and I think VMRC is equally frustrated by the fact that they've got this, well, there's been grass there. Our recommendation is going to be we don't lease it. I don't know.
I think that's going to work just fine for new leases. But if we change the definition of an SAV bed, we could put existing leases in jeopardy. And I think that's a bigger concern to me than new leases. Because I think you guys do a good job on new leases right now in terms of identifying whether or not there's SAV there and whether or not they are leasable because of the presence and or potential. But it's the leases that are already out there that we could potentially really impact by making a couple of these changes. That's the biggest concern, I think.
Yep, I agree with that. I mean, that's what concerns me right now. I just don't think we thought all that through last meeting.
And new leases, I don't have a question with it. You guys do a good job on the new leases. But, you know, there's 100,000 acres already leased.
Plus
Baylor. Which we'd love to lease, but they won't let us.
Well, you know, I'm not open on that this time.
I think you're right. I mean, the cat's out of the bag here, but
yeah.
I think we, from a culture SAV complex standpoint, mm-hmm. while it was just clam aquaculture, and that's the origin of the industry and some of the restoration that with SAV up until they had recent buybacks. I mean, you know, one kind of went with the other, maybe. And like I said, they're mutually exclusive to some extent as some overlap. But I think what's happened that's brought this to a head, and maybe we've got to deal with it, and maybe there's some not so pleasant outcomes for all of us on either side of the equation, from the manager side or the agriculture side, is that the aquaculture industry with regard to oysters has changed. Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing these conflicts that aren't really covered very well through the existing regulation. And I don't know that it's appropriate to stick our head in the sand, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I think we've got to deal with some of them face to face. I mean, I think there's some resolution
most of the industry prefers bottom cages to floats.
For ice damage and stuff like that.
And ease of work, labor.
Youth conflicts. I mean, and the big conflicts. Thing,
yeah.
People don't hardly want to look at bottom cages that come exposed at extreme low tides, much less look at an array of floating cages in front of their house. That ain't going to work on the Western Shore unless you, like, there's a guy up in the Guinea Marsh on Mundy's Creek. That's what he does. But he's the only one. There's nobody there. Nothing but the Guineaman. They don't care.
Yeah, and there's no grass anywhere near
him. Yeah, but for me to put that in Sages Creek or out on the main stem of the York River, it wouldn't happen.
Yeah,
But I'd also add that the industry is very young, as we're talking about. Mm-hmm. There are other areas throughout the country that are just proliferating in floating gear.
That's right.
And it is by far and away the most popular method in other areas of the country. There's also a price point differential on floating gear. It's more expensive. So I think people have been slower to adopt it. And I think the industry's still trying to figure out what works best.
My feeling is it's coming. I mean, we're seeing some floating proposals.
Sure, yeah.
And, I think the idea was that you can't make money at that. It's just too labor intensive. It doesn't work. It's how, whatever you can come up with, it just wasn't going to work. Well, I think some people are making it work in various areas. But on the other hand, from an SAV standpoint, we're here talking about SAV and how to manage conflicts and define the conflicts and the terms. You don't have to put floating cage over an SAV deck. You can move it 100 yards further offshore and hopefully you get away from the SAV. And there are areas where you don't have to be near the shore and run into the neighbor conflict and have a viable industry. Maybe a few more minutes of travel time to get there, and you may end up with just a monitoring issue. I know some of this is, can I see it? Can I keep my eye on it? But, does the middle of Hog Island Bay work for shellfish aquaculture and floats? I don't know, but you're not going to hurt anybody out in the middle of Hog Island Bay, I don't think. I use that example way too often, I suppose. But there's any number of areas probably around Gloucester and Guinea Point, and then, you could put cages and wouldn't bother a soul and not worry about it.
I think it's... The shellfish industry, I can tell you, is feeling squeezed from all sides. And the middle of the bay sounds great till you think of storms and your cage is washing up in Virginia Beach or somewhere. We're getting squeezed by homeowners. We have sea level rise we're now starting to deal with. We have warming temperatures, so people are looking for deeper water. Even though the press is stating that our industry's great and growing, I think we feel squeezed from all sides. Even though I've only been in it a short time, more than I've seen. It feels like we're growing, but we also just see this land grab, and we're growing all on the same body of water, so it just feels like everything's getting tighter and tighter and tighter, and I think we're seeing more conflicts with SAV because of that, as well as more conflicts with homeowners because of that, as well as these new culture methods.
By the way, just as
actually, I'm on the Eastern Shore for the Shorekeepers water event.
Yeah. What was that, JJ?
No, watch it on TV?
Yeah. Later.
Yeah.
But be aware of that, because I'm not sure where it's going to go, but just for your information, since it's in Boston, it's in Boston County.
So I'm not sure if we need to vote here, but
are you getting anything out of this and what you want to do? And you mentioned, well, let's just put this up on the map so we know.
Yeah.
I think we got to report back to the commission something, but let's do nothing or not. I think we could do a couple things. We could put on the maps what's a bed. Based on this concept, that it's 5-year average or 5-year composite. We're going to show that, and we'll update it every 5 years. That's a bet. And what could be a bet is, it was $185,000, $77,000, or something more recent. It's just what we've seen coverage since. In this case, it's 71. Should we do 85? And those are just going to be showing up on the map.
Mm-hmm.
So we hit two bullets there, but have we done enough? I think we have to tell the commission, here's the things we ran into. Here's how we're doing it. Here's some conflicts we've run into. Are we okay, or do we need to more clearly define the criteria under which certain things can occur?
I think that one thing you need to do is tell the commission that the current review
for new leases is adequate, and it takes into account the trends and the SAV. So for new leases, I think SAV is being adequately protected. The question and concerns are really with the existing leases and any resurgence of SAV on those leases. That's the problem, not new leases.
And Tony, to your point, you mentioned 10 years ago we wouldn't even be talking about this because it wasn't profitable to grow oysters. Well, it was nearly 20, well, I've been doing it 21 years growing oysters, and I was on the original committee that Chip and somebody, Jay, was it Jay, set up, and Mike might have been there. Mike Pearson was on it. And we defined a 12-inch tray because that's what I was using and what everybody was using, a lot of people were using. And, I mean, so that's how long that's been going on.
Yeah, I know, your time may not have been quite correct, but I would suggest that the intensity of that technique is...
Yeah, that's true. The industry is growing, but I've been going by that and doing what I was supposed to be doing for 21 years. And it really concerns me now that a few sentences and a few changes here and there, and I'm going to be thrown out. So me and others, I know, but, you know, not just me, but there's going to be a whole host of other people that could be adversely affected by this.
And so, I mean, I think, to your point, Tony, of what do we report back to the commission, I think we're in danger if we define an SAV bed. I'm not sure if that's what the intent is with the mapping, but if we map all those areas and say these are SAV beds, all of a sudden it becomes unauthorized to have a cage or a shelf, a clam net on any of those areas, which I'm guessing would put a whole lot of the industry out of business.
Most of it.
So I think we could maybe do the online mapping tool without defining beds and just saying, you know, overlaying the VIMS data with the VMRC lease map. That's all we're doing. We're not defining what an SAV bed is. So VIMS data, whether it's, you might be able to select each year, I'm not sure how the tech would work.
The tools out there are impressive.
Yeah.
And so much can be done. All the data are probably going to be made data available. And for a current year, if a person needs the data for the current year, even though we don't release it publicly, we always allow people to have data that's really necessary. So it's probably the least, but that's not the way we operate. It's like if you need it, we'll give it to you. It's just that the data have to be QA, QC, and all that has to get. Like, I think in several cases, where someone says, hey, I really need the current data.
Sure.
Running on those lease maps would allow everyone to see where potential conflict is coming from.
Right, yeah. And then, because I think the conflict we came into was someone putting cages, they don't think there was SAV there, and I can understand that. I mean, you're out on the water. You're not 12,000 feet up. It's hard to see where exactly the SAV is, particularly if it's not there all the time. You put some cages out, but if they were able to go back on their computer, say I'm thinking about expanding into this area, and say, oh, man, there's SAV there 3 years ago. That's going to be a problem. That would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. The imagery is all digital, so I mean, it's very impressive to be able to see that level that roughly 5 years and you can see things.
Yep.
And the policy of leasing new ground, the idea of going back and just looking on that last 5 years would tell someone real quickly, we're not going to be able to support this. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. What we're seeing is that probably still going to apply. I'm hoping it goes away about 2 or 3 years before the survey.
Better go ahead and get our applications in now, huh? Yeah.
But we'll have to figure a way around that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a great concept, I think, for new leases, that you've got some guidance, new leases, new permits, that you've got some guidance to look for. rather than going all the way back to 1971 or whatever it may be, to just immediately say no rather than having to send them 100 applications. You can send them maybe the 10 that are kind of gray.
We can actually just do a policy and hire a survey engineer on the criteria of what we're looking at.
Right. And then, yeah.
That's one paragraph.
Yeah, and it wouldn't apply to existing leases, so it takes these concerns away of that we're having.
And we're not standing out there being arbitrary as well. Now we've got a policy.
Yeah.
So that report back to the commission was just map the areas, show them on the blue maps.
But develop the in-house policy for new leases using the review process using the tools.
I guess from one standpoint, I mean, that's not a whole lot different than what we've been doing. We do have the code section that we've, better or worse, danced around for years.
Mm-hmm.
De facto used the vague program information on what is current bid, or what is mapped year to year to define a bid, you know. And then we have the purple map that shows what it historically was, and that's potentially where it could be, basically. The Bay Program goal is established in Virginia 77,500 acres of SAP. And here's a map showing where it will probably be. So we kind of took the position and kind of took care of it. The commission never said grace over that. It's just been done as a working process. Maybe that's enough. Board. I don't know what you're talking about here, but you could argue that that code section met the board. I guess I was kind of hoping we get to a point where we were clearly articulating what those beds were and what those potential areas were for the benefit of not only the aquaculture industry, but the applicant public who wants to do something on state submerged lands, and the rest of the public who is concerned about, you know, protection and restoration of Commonwealth resource. And so I'm sitting here looking at what we've done and whether or not there's any other alternative, which would be from an aquaculture standpoint, saying, you know, restoration of SAV occurs in areas where we define some boundary based on the 7185 or the 2010 goal. But it doesn't include areas where there's currently aquaculture activity. And, you know, we got maps that kind of show it. I mean, we got aerial photography that's kind of hard to argue with, I think, at this level, to say, okay, we know where you are now if we look at it close enough.
Mm-hmm.
What that then means, though, with regard to using a very sparsely populated area, as has been suggested, is occurring. And we recognize that, golly, you know, yeah, there's spots within that bed where there might be enough room to put a few nets, and that's been done. And we're not requiring their removal. But I think that would require tweaking the home bottom regulation and probably the general permit regulation to recognize that there are sparsely populated beds that where agriculture occurred.
I think we're opening a big can of worms.
That's the dilemma I think we find ourselves in today as a result of this path we've gone down. Question. assume they're different, or assume they're the same.
Well, you know, industry has always recognized that, okay, I've got this 5-acre lease, and 1 acre of it is real good, and 2 acres of them are SAV, and I know that I'm not going to be able to plant in that SAV. So they use the 1 acre extensively, and then they use the other 2 acres intermittently. But if you define the whole 5 acres as a bed, that takes those 3 acres that don't have stands of SAV out of the equation. That 5 acres is now useless, period.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, they recognize that there's spots on their lease that there's SAV and they're not going to put beds on or their nets on. But on that same lease, there are clear areas or sparsely populated SAV areas that are totally acceptable for aquacultural use. Changing the definition of an SAV bed is going to cripple the shellfish industry of Virginia, period.
Well, I guess what might be interesting is to take a look at what that would look like. Because from my understanding, they're not going to say that whole lease is an SAV bed. I mean, the mapping program's pretty detailed. The bed is literally going to be defined as where SAV is or was. But, you know, I think everybody's uncomfortable to do something like this without having a visual of, let's see, what's defined as an SAV bed. Mm-hmm. And we could probably look at it with some earth imagery that would say, hey, this is defined as an SAV bed, but you see a bunch of oyster cages there.
Mm-hmm.
Or we don't see any SAV there. And, you know, just seeing how big these expanses are. I think right now the operating rule of thumb is you're just out there and you know whether there's grass or not. And I'd be curious, and I guess I can do it using the VIMS website, but go look at my leases and see, are there areas I was planning on putting in cages that they're saying is an SAV bed, and we think of it as not having any SAV on it.
Closely, especially on the eastern shore, you know, from Old Plantation up to Nassau Waters, which is, I think, just about the northern limit of the plant culture, you'll see a lot of strange pollinators.
Yeah, so I mean, I think I understand the fear here, but I'm not sure we're that far off. I think what we're afraid of is that they're going to take an existing lease and call the whole thing an SAV bed, and then we couldn't move a cage somewhere on it. But the reality is they're only calling what's an SAV bed an area where there's been SAV. So by the regulation as it stands today, we still couldn't put a cage on it.
Right.
But it's just, I'm not sure we're changing the definition of an SAV bed at all, which is what everybody's afraid of. Yeah. But at the same time, I don't...
We're going to enforce it, I think, is what it falls back.
Yeah. And the benefits from the commission perspective to this are that we've got a defined criteria, right? That's kind of why you're in favor of it. And what you guys like about it, Hank, is that this is a defined criteria, 5 years, whatever we call it, rather than just subjective measures.
But so far, I mean, everything seems to be working okay.
And yeah.
Why tweak the system that has been working really well? Obviously, I know the issues with existing stuff is a problem, but we've been working with the system. Mm-hmm.
Because there's 90% that doesn't have it.
Exactly. And now, if we're defined, we can go, okay, it's had SAV on it for 5 years, and we're going to be recommending denial of it to the commission if it ever gets that far. You can still apply and go through this process, but that's our standard. It won't be, well, we'll talk to JJ, maybe, yep. Maybe not, and we'll get back with you in 2 or 3 weeks with an answer. Mm-hmm. It's more defined. It may not be, it's easier on me, I guess, but it may not be the best solution.
Sure.
But once again, that's for new leases. Yeah. And I think for new leases, that works perfectly. But for existing leases, we've got potential problems.
You're talking about for that 0 to 10% range where it might be 2% SAV coverage. And that's basically not comprehensible to the grower standing on the water. You'd never correct. See it, right. But it's going to be defined in their maps as SAV.
Correct.
But wouldn't we still be running into that problem today? Because they're going to do their flyovers, which the case they brought us here, mm-hmm. and say this is in the 0 to 10% area.
That
and
was there's separate than
10%. No. Right. But. Okay. I'm just not sure what changes here. I get the fear, but I'm not sure this is changing anything.
I don't think it is. Having gone through the permitting process, starting with the, oh, there's SAV there, no, to eventually getting everybody in the same room and saying, well, this area within your lease is fine. I think that's the ultimate goal, is to allow the industry to utilize existing leases.
I think my perspective on how that evolved is that a proposal was submitted to use the whole lease for agriculture.
Yep.
And we said, that part of that lease has sure. SAV on it. We can't accept that proposal. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the alternative was, then we finally got together and tell you, well, to define where that boundary was.
Sure.
And you amended your application.
Yeah.
Right. Application, but I think that speaks to your concern.
So that's the process. That's our day-to-day job.
Yeah.
You know, to do things like that. So that's the process for dealing with that.
Well, and that's why I guess I don't quite understand the sensitivity to, it works well for the new ones versus the existing. I'm not sure we're changing the process. I think we're hopefully giving better definition so that people going forward that have existing leases know a better defined process, that it's not an exclusion, it's how much can you use of your lease.
Well, if that's the case, then we really don't have to change anything because the process is already in place.
Well, again, just going back to my original thing, I do think that as I read the regs, when it talks about existing beds or existing condition, to me that means today. It doesn't mean going back 5 years.
Right.
And I think that's something that needs to be clarified, because as a permit writer, when I see existing and I go out on my kayak and I have nothing, not that I'm the best delineator, but I'm thinking, well, there's nothing here.
And that may be seasonal as well as annual.
Season, absolutely. Absolutely. So, in my mind, a better definition of, you know, what an existing bed actually is, which is really a five-year study, I think that just, and the knowledge that, you know, and I guess one of my other frustrations was I had the VIMS work and I had the VMRC work, and it didn't get overlaid. I didn't have the capability of doing that. Unfortunately, through my friends at VIMS and VMRC, that happened. It made it so much easier. So I think that's a major step in the right direction. Because, again, some of the leases, I just don't see a problem. We had one in Mattawoman Creek that there was very clearly an SAV area that historically been the case, and there'd been some migration down, I guess, from Hungers. But again, the majority of that lease was leasable. Usable.
So my wavering opinion on this, that I reserve the right to change again in 2 minutes, is that, you know, we our guidance is for commission staff to work with VIMS to overlay that data on the commission's maps. And I don't believe making any other changes than to make that data available. And maybe there's a guidance or something with a lease application. Would that make sense to, or maybe it's just accomplished with the map data, but I'm trying to get at the problem of someone saying, oh, well, this is only 0 to 10%. I can use 90% of the lease. And part of the reason why we're here is a lack of knowledge on the applicants. How can we make it easier for folks to understand what this process is? Maybe that's a phone call, but in this day and age, I probably speak for Generation X over here, but we don't use the phone a whole lot. We look to the internet for what everything is. Yeah. But I think the mapping's a great start.
All right. Go back to one last thing. We talked about 5 years versus 3 years. Would you like for me, by the time this gets to the commission, to report that you were in favor, agree with 5 years, or would you rather propose three? Staff may not agree with three. We might think five's better because of, I think you've heard about recovery periods. Does it matter to you?
I don't think we're talking about that at this point anymore. I mean, my recommendation or opinion was to just simply provide the VIMS data. You could provide 30 years, 20 years, so that each person has the right to click on it, just like you were earlier, where you said, show me the, I think it was 2010 to 2014, and then you had the 71 to 2014 available. Maybe pick five different tranches that's available on the mapping data. I think the question of new leases, is that what you're asking for on the 5 years? Or?
Well, yeah. What it gets back really to, if we put some on the maps, it's going to be de facto, this is what we're viewing as a bed. You know, is it a five-year period or a three-year period that we wouldn't have? And what I just heard you say was, provide a tool that allows for anyone to create a period they want, you know. And that might be a bit much
right.
to do that just digitally. I mean, I'm sure it can be done, but it might get very, very complicated and cumbersome in terms of what you see as an outcome. But
redefining a bed for me is more confusing because most people, I think of a single year as a bed. And it gets, you have this kind of funny nesting thing if you have a 5 year bed with a 1 year bed in there. I wonder if it'd be better to have another term for that, like the period of time that's been, you know, recent history or something. Then you have the years on in there. That makes sense.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree that bed may not be the best term. I'm focused on bed because it's in the Code of Virginia. It says the commission shall define an existing bed that uses that term. That's the term we ask it.
would.
I guess we can define what bed is. It's a stand. It's a 1 year, period. That's what we're getting at, I guess.
But we've already heard from Hank and Ben that they go back 5 years minimum, sometimes more. We've heard from JJ that 5 years is about recovery time.
It seems for the last 3 periods.
So it sounds like your staff is already using 5 years for new leases. JJ seems to think 5 is reasonable. So for a, quote, new lease, use 5 years. But I would not discourage the current negotiation between MRC staff and the lessors about what they can and cannot do on the lease. That's still critical that the dialogue takes place.
As Tony, you guys have said, this is an evolving process. Yeah. I would say that this is the end. It's really just the end of the beginning. I would like to think that we'll learn from all of this and just move forward to see how it operates.
I'm a little nervous. I know the code says we have to define a bed. How is it defined today?
It isn't.
Well, like I said, we've looked at the mapping, see what shows up.
Yeah.
But we never have settled on, is it just last year, previous few years? It was like, all right, let's look at the map and see if it's there. And if we look at this year, it's not there, but we realize through our knowledge and doing this that, you know what, it's been out there consistently in this area for the last 5 or 10 years, and we just have 1 year that it wasn't there. We think we should consider that, a bed of SAV.
Right.
But we've never formally written that down to say it's 5 years. And what that means, though, is that if it disappeared from a, let's say it's been there for, had been there for 20 years until 2012. And it hadn't been there since 2012. Come around 2017, it's not there that year. That's no longer a bed. That's the concept that we're trying to articulate. But the flip side of that is it's been there for the last 10, didn't occur the year before, didn't occur this year, but it comes back the following year. There's a 5 year period in there where there is SAV, so it still isn't dead. We had just used our judgment to say, hey, looking at this last year, it's not there. We don't see it. It's not been there for quite some time. We're okay with allowing something to occur or permitting it. The flip is, we've seen it, there quite persistently over a given period of time, and even though it didn't show up last year and someone thinks it's not SAV, they should get to use it, we're saying no, we don't.
And I guess the flip side is, though, from the aquaculture's perspective of if I plant a clam bed for 10 years and then leave it fallow for 2 years and SAV grows on it, it's not defined as my clam bed anymore. It becomes
and that's where I'm thinking that if we were to go down this path of something similar to what's drafted here today, that concept, I think, would somehow need to get captured to cover if that's the prerogative of the commission.
But we have the industry to be able to tell you how long you need to cover. That's the interesting thing about this industry that we know from the industry what block plant blocks have been really found and how long we can see the best path. Because it's very clear that established blocks are ones that are really block.
Right.
Right,
but we're affording SAV this ability to go and come without us putting clams on the SAV. But if I choose to leave some clam grounds barren for a while and SAV comes in, I'm not afforded that same right to then put my clams back on it.
And how do you put clams back in an SAB area? It seems to me that we don't have to go in there and plow the SAB up in order to make it work.
Yeah. I'm just pointing out that it's and I'm not even saying it should be fair. I don't know the science. What's more valuable, SAV or clams? Probably only you guys can tell us that. But it's just doesn't seem to be equivalent.
Clams taste better.
I think we'll probably wrap it up. I think we've got a couple of paths to follow. One is that we could go back to the commission since we looked at this and the committee couldn't agree on recommending any substantial changes to current policies and procedures, mm-hmm. except that we all have to define a 5-year period for the presence of SAV on a given area when we consider leasing. Mm-hmm. And that we continue, you know, our ongoing evaluation of what occurs on existing leases on a case-by-case basis and evaluation of SAV coverage. I mean, that's kind of what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Just writing some words down here. In my mind, what I would say to the commission. But so I think we can leave it at that. I don't know if it gets us where we need to be entirely given some of the issues we've identified here as a result of the request to reevaluate where we stand on our SAV policy. The other option, I think, is take a crack at some of these concepts you've identified as concerns and see if we could articulate some criteria or guideline to deal with it. Like the stand, if you know, want to put SAV culture trays out in an area that's less than, that's up to 10% in that yellow area, you just can't put it on SAV plants. That's the stand. Could we define that? I guess we could. So, or, and then this issue of you've got aquaculture structures out there, you've been using a certain area within your lease, aquaculture, SAVs come in around it. As you lay areas fallow and plant new areas within that area you've always been using, you can continue to use that same area. And just let the commission state that formally, and that it would not then prevent you from using it. You know, you were two down the road if you hadn't used it, left it fallow, and SAV happened to move in.
It would be grandfathered, basically?
Grandfathered, maybe that's a good word to use, I don't know. But, you know, so the idea is that we go back to the drawing board with some of these concerns, and we meet again, come back to you with another straw man to see if we hit the mark or not, and if we have or can come to something great and move forward with it. If not, we would then go back to the commission and say just status quo with the exception of the 5-year mapping for the lease, the new lease.
So you're essentially suggesting that there be two sets of guidelines, one for a new application and one for existing leases.
Well, one guideline that covers several issues.
Right. But the guidelines don't have to be the same is what I'm getting at.
Right. And we think in mind, too, that when we look at this, we're thinking other activities as well, not just that.
So I said applications and not aquaculture.
I mean, do you want to take another stab at something? Give it some thought on your end. I mean, you've got what I've written down. You all have had good comments today. Send me thoughts in writing. Send me some emails. We'll see what we can work out. I mean, and get meet again, and if we don't get any further, we've got a sort of a, I think, one avenue is the 5-year lease, the 5 years of coverage for lease consideration, and then just status quo on how we've been dealing with it. Chad, I mean, y'all want to meet again?
Yeah, I feel like I haven't fully grasped everything yet. I'd like
you haven't had this very long. Yeah. We just sent it to you last Friday.
Yep. I'd like to take another crack at it rather than going back to the commission and saying we wasted a lot of time for two meetings and don't don't have any concrete recommendations. I feel like we had good discussion here, and we're all sort of learning as we go along, and that another go round would be a good thing.
We can have something you all may want to consider. If we have access to all that data, we might run through some of the case studies and you actually see how this operates. Just a suggestion. Mm-hmm. That maybe have the next week at the end, we can actually look at some of the leases that have been done, things that have worked, have to work. Just a suggestion.
Yep. Somewhere where we're not trying to delineate a faint yellow and a brown. And I'd be in favor of that. Yeah.
You can get electric power generators.
But that might be something to consider, because I think we're kind of at a point that this hung up, we don't know the
situation. Sure.
Sure. That'd be valuable.
That has a lease line and the SAB line on the same. I imagine it'd be something that'd be helpful for you to spend some time looking through that when you know, rather than trying to all do it together, you may want to look at some areas you're really familiar with and see what it really means in a context that you're very familiar with.
Can you send that link to Tony and get Tony to send it to us, please?
To send it to you, you're on the email, right?
Yeah.
So we can just forward all
okay.
the line.
Just if you could do that
sure.
in the next day or so.
And I think Tony and Hank, it'd be helpful if y'all could come up with, while we're looking at all this, you may as well just come up with what would make VMRC's job easier and this more efficient. And, you know, I think our opinion is pretty easy to guess at. We just want more land. So if you could kind of formulate something from our side, something that would make y'all more efficient, and anything VIMS is trying, we may as well look at this thing from a 360-degree point of view while we're doing it.
What's the VMRC Google link or leasing map? What's different between that and what you guys are talking about? You know,
they don't have any SAB information.
Yes, it does have an overlay.
It's just 1 year older data.
So. And I don't think it overlays, so you can't view a lease line and the SAV
no,
at the
can't.
Same time. You just can see SAV.
Yeah, I thought you could.
I'm just not capable of using it then.
I mean, there's so many different colors.
Yeah, but also, I don't believe you have all of our imagery. Probably not. Because you really see all of the releases on our own day. Good old
so that's what you will send us the link to?
Yes.
Okay.
Free of charge.
We already paid for it.
Just
back to where we started.
Well, I don't think so. You know, we identified some problematic terms and some misunderstandings. So that in itself is valuable.
All right, good enough.
I wish I was there with you.
I'm there, but it's just getting aggravating.